Iku Iluna, please rise. Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hana hano u a ko koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-19-0000704. In the matter of the application of Pioneer Mill Company Limited and Kahoma Land LLC. Arguing for petitioners, Gladiola Aloha Schneider et al., Michael Matsukawa. Arguing for respondents, Arlene K. Kakalia et al., David B. Kaapu. Arguing for respondent, Kahoma Land LLC, Keone Schultz. Also appearing, Doreen Matsuoka. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. I'd like to thank and welcome our Substitute Justice, Judge James Kawashima. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? All right. The court's allocated 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Matsukawa, you will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Kaapu, you'll have 10 minutes. Mr. Schultz, you'll have 30 minutes, and we'll give you a warning with 1 minute to go in your argument. Please proceed, Mr. Matsukawa.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. The petitioner's appellants asked this court to vacate the land court's decree number 217. As to the land called Kuhua or Lot 3A, or to simply dismiss the case altogether for reasons stated on the brief. If the court below, the land court, is apparently not capable of complying with this court's new trial mandate since 1972, then this court should use its supervisory powers to reach a just result. As a matter of introduction, I think it's important for the court to understand the significance of the land itself which is in play. The lands were awarded to some of the highest ranking ali'i in Hawaii during the mahele. Somehow, and fortunately to the benefit of the Kanaina family, a set of keeper's land at Kahua, Land Commission Award 7582, passed to Ha'alelea. His estate was subject to estate sales, but somehow nobody knew that Kuhua had passed to him. So during the estate sales, nothing happened to Kuhua. It sat there. When Ha'alelea died, the property passed to Luna Lilo. As this court knows, in 1881, this court ordered the trustees of Luna Lilo's estate to sell all his lands over the objections of the trustees. Again, nobody knew Kuhua was part of this estate, so it passed on to Kanaina, his father. So this property had gone through the process of transfer, escaped the estate sales, and survived intact for Charles Kanaina and his heirs. Many of them are seated in this courtroom today. And to the east is Luna Lilo's tomb at Kawaihao Church. So there's a lot of significance to the land and where we are today. Kahoma Land kick-started this case in 2009, several years since the 1972 court order. I don't think there's been any case that has lingered in this court's history this long, and maybe the only original registration case that's still pending. I don't think there's any other registration case except for the recent accretion case over in Oahu.
Counsel, can I ask you, you know, when I was looking through the docket, and this is obviously a voluminous record, you have from 1983 to 1993, I see no action going on the docket, and then again from 93 to 2009. You know, we're talking several decades where there was nothing at all going on, and that's after the 1972
That's correct.
Ruling. What was going on during that time, and if latches applies, what would happen after that?
Well, that's been the subject of some of the briefing, but on what happened, the record on appeal, I think it's docket number 134, which covers the 1982 period. The court did hold conferences with counsel. They scheduled a hearing. At one hearing, Titus Napoleon's daughter, he was one of the Kanaina heirs who appeared at the first trial in 1967.
Wait, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but what I'm trying to get at, was there anything precluding the prosecution of this case?
Nope.
By Pioneer or Kahoma, whoever it was, from 1983 to 93, a whole decade, and then from 93 to 2009? Anything stopping them or precluding them from moving the case forward instead of leaving it in abeyance?
The record is silent as to why it didn't move forward, but I could not see any impediment that's in the record. What I did see, and it's in that docket, I think it's 134, there's some discussion as to who were the parties for the new trial. Was it just the state and Pioneer Mill? Was it the state, Pioneer Mill, and others? And so some of the others did appear at several of the trial setting conferences. Mamaki appeared for, the Mamaki estate was present. Titus Napoleon's daughter was present and made a party. But the record is silent after that.
So if latches applies, what happens to the case on that property from there?
My position on it is that if latches does apply, then the application should be dismissed, but not without prejudice. Kahoma Land, as a substitute applicant, can still maintain either a new application or proceed in the Maui Circuit Court.
Are you taking that position with respect to lots 1 and 2 also?
No.
No one here is making any claims to the 2016 decree, is that correct?
That's correct.
So lots 1 and 2, we're talking about lot 3.
Yeah.
Lot 3A is what you're really asserting.
What's in issue today is lot 3A.
But now, along those lines, after this court ruled that Judge King had no jurisdiction after he made his announcement that he was running for lieutenant governor, he entered an order ordering the subdivision of lot 3 into 3A, and that actually happened.
That's correct.
So he was without jurisdiction to order that, but it went ahead and that happened.
Well, that's one part of this case that puzzled me as to at what point what things could he not do? Because the statute did say that.
We made it very clear. This court made it very clear that he was without jurisdiction to do anything after he made his announcement. And this took place, his order for the subdivision took place after the announcement, same day as the findings that ended up being appealed.
That's correct.
March 13th, 1970.
Yeah. I didn't know which came first. Because there was a pretrial conference, and at the pretrial conference, the record and appeal shows that they had discussed the subdivision. But that's only in the pretrial. You know, nothing happened.
Are any of the parties disputing the subdivision at this point? I understand that some of the parcels have been transferred to other parties.
Well, Pu'uki was part of that, as was Aki. And my clients have made claims to both Aki
that is 3
and Kuhua that are part of lot 3.
Okay.
Yeah. But
I'm sorry, go ahead.
At least one of them has been transferred to another party. Is that right?
Well, Pu'uki was transferred to the state of Hawaii, but the state has not come in to be substituted as the applicant as to Pu'uki. And the state's not here today. Aki and Ha'ake are part of Lot 3, and is as is Kuhua. But my clients make no claim to Pu'uki that ran to the estate of Brown and Mamaki. Our clients claim Kuhua and Aki. Aki is also known as Ha'ake.
I'm sorry, so does that mean that, as the ICA appears to have concluded, you're not only contesting the other lots besides 3A, but the 78.704% that was allocated is also not in contention, or is that going to be an issue for trial?
I didn't understand the question.
The ICA felt that appellants are not disputing having no claim to the 78.704% of Lot 3A. Is that a settled issue in your mind at this point, or is that something that needs to be addressed?
Well, that needs to be addressed. That's one of the assignments of error, that the ICA and the land court's analysis of this 78%, 22% was a proper procedure to follow.
You are taking the position that co-tenants, co-descendants, should be able to assert the ownership rights of other co-descendants.
That's correct.
And you cited to an Alabama case, which is apparently based on an Alabama tax repossession, when you regain property from a tax sale. You also cited to other cases, but it appears to be cases relating to possession of property by co-tenants and how co-tenants can seek to enforce possession.
That's correct. That's correct.
On behalf of other co-tenants.
That's correct.
Makes eminent sense. Yeah.
But we do have local precedent. We cited the Godfrey case where...
Which the ICA distinguished.
Yes,
right?
And that was erroneous. Because the Godfrey case is as clear as could be stated. If one co-tenant may affirmatively initiate efforts to eject a stranger, then why isn't that same person entitled to protect the property against that stranger should that stranger bring an adverse possession?
But again, those are possession cases. And that's
correct. That's correct.
So
it's not paper title cases.
You're asking it to be extended to... You're asking us to extend it to protecting title, right? Not just possession, but title.
Well, we make the distinction between paper title and possession.
Okay.
Because you can gain ownership through either paper title, deed, descent, or by possession. And the ICA and the land court, we argue, confuse the two. And that's why we have this difficult dilemma before everyone. It's difficult to explain in concept that you can adverse land, which is tangible, but you can't adverse the intangible concept of title.
Yeah. Mr. Matsukawa, you said, I know in your briefing you questioned the land courts or allowing Kahoma to sort of recharacterize the claim to a 78% interest. And I think your position was that deprived the land court of jurisdiction at that point.
Yes.
Can you explain that argument to us, please?
I must correct myself because I state in the brief that Section 50125 does not allow multiple parcels to be joined in a single application unless the applicant claims the same interest in each of the parcels. In 1931, that statute was amended to say what it says today, that the claim has to be the same. Whether the person actually owns the interest is a matter of a variance. So I can come in and say I claim 100% here, 100% here, 100% there, but end up proving that I only own 60% of one of those parcels. The legislature intended to create a variance to say that doesn't affect jurisdiction. But when the legislature amended the statute, it doesn't apply retroactively. You know, Section 1-3 does not allow retroactive application of that amendment.
But right now, you're saying if this claim had been filed now, since 50125 does say two or more parcels shall not be included in one application unless the claim is of the same interest in each parcel. So in other words, since this application, if it was filed now and included parcels 1, 2, and 3, since they were claiming paper title to 1 and 2, but adverse possession as to parcel 3, this would not be able to be filed now under 501-25.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you.
What about the issue of a publication notice or the notice that was provided to identify that 78% interest? Was it adequate in this case? And can your clients, is that part of what you're saying your clients can assert as tenants in common?
Well, my clients, Your Honor, were fortunate that they were aware of the property, so they made a claim. But to your question, this has been a troubling issue because how do you serve notice in the land court? If you follow the statute, it's somewhat different from Hustis versus Alpuni, and there's quite a different analysis. But in the most part, in this case, when the notice came out in 2009, 2010, the notice read, you are notified that the court intends to enter a default judgment.
It didn't say.
Doesn't say who. It didn't say heirs of Canina.
It didn't say heirs of.
There's no Canina. Name. And the statute says that it must contain a name. Yeah. My time is up, so thank you.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. One more question. So we do have a question. Yes, no, please. And please go ahead.
I'm sorry, Counselor. I just wanted to ask real quickly. I thought you were applying 50125 in that the interest asserted, if it's 100%, 100% lots 1 and 2, it has to be 100% in lot 3. That's not your argument?
No, that is my argument.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it is my argument. What I'm saying is when the statute was amended in 1931 to say you need only claim, not own the same, that was not retroactive to the application that was filed in 1919.
I'm sorry. I thought you were making a distinction between paper title and adverse possession, but I understand the position.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Muscala. Mr. Ka'apu.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. I would like to discuss the notice issues that Chief Justice raised. If you look at the facts of this case, it becomes very clear that notice, as required by the Land Court statute, was never given. The Land Court must give actual notice via registered letter, according to the statute. That was not done in 1919. That was not done at any other publication that took place subsequently. And so we believe procedurally that the process has been so flawed that we are requesting that this court dismiss the application. Petitioner is free to file a quiet title case in the Second Circuit or file another application here. In addition to being procedurally defective, we also believe that substantively this application was defective because the Land Court statute also requires that the Attorney General represent the interest of those who didn't show up but have an interest or who may have an interest in the property.
Which statute was that again?
That is 542. Sorry, I don't have that, but it's in the case of In Re Complaint of Vakrat, which is, Hawaii 201, it's a 1968 case,
okay,
in which they described In Re Vakrat was a circuit court case in Maui where the plaintiff tried to bring a quiet title case in rem and was successful for a while. He served by publication and he served four adjoining landowners by name. When the landowner showed up, they asked the circuit court to dismiss. The circuit court denied the dismissal. So they asked for an interlocutory appeal, which came up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that the Attorney General is required to contest an application where there are grounds for a contest, but no adverse claimant has raised them. In this case, in 1919, the Attorney General would have been there, but no one represented the interests of the non-appearing parties because they were only named by the land. So the notice went out as against the land, and unless you knew the land, there's really no way that you'd be apprised that you needed to show up. defaults were taken after 1919. Defaults were entered in 1925. Prior to the trial, Judge King held the trial, as you know, and the state attorney general was there, but they were only representing the state's interests because they wanted Hahakea and subsequently entered into a stipulation so that the parties agreed that the state would get that parcel and Pioneer Mill would get the balance.
Counsel, going back to your notice issue, way back then, it seemed that Mr. Kanaina's heirs included some pretty notable people, two princesses, yes, in fact,
yes,
who owned a third,
that's correct,
of the land. Did they not receive personal notice?
They did not. There is nothing in the record that shows that any written letter, registered letter, was sent to any of these people. And the estate of Kanaina was in this court back and forth over a period of 5 years. So it started after Kanaina's death in 1877. Wasn't finished until 1882. And during that time, the heirs of Kanaina were well known to everyone because it was the king had asked to be an heir,
yeah,
and he was denied.
It did strike me, maybe they weren't reading the Wailuku Times, but it seems that they are powerful enough to have, it just seems odd that they would forego any interest in this property. And I think that's what I sense you're arguing with respect to the notice issue.
Correct.
So notice can be raised at any time?
Correct.
Why did the land court do it the way it did it in 2009? Does the record explain why the land court adopted this procedure?
It is unclear. We raised that with Judge Chang at the time. And if you recall, the notice went out because the land court was telegraphing its intention to enter default judgment. And so it noticed the public that that was its position. And interestingly enough, many heirs of Kanaina found out about it and showed up. How they knew? No idea.
Very well. Thank you.
All right. In any case.
Is it your position then is that the case should be dismissed ab initio from the beginning?
Yes.
So put aside parcel one, whether it's parcel one, two, or three.
That is my client's position, is that it should be dismissed.
And to make it clear for the record, your client is?
The Kakalia heirs. We have heirs of Kahonu and the Lopez family, the Kakalias, Salausa, and Lopez families.
Thank you.
Does Hackfield have any interest in the property?
No, not that I know of.
I mean, it got taken away from him after World War I.
It did. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
The playbook was later used in World War II, I suppose, as well.
Correct.
But no interest for Hockville.
Not that I am aware of, Justice.
Thank you.
So what would happen to the subdivision then? That would, the subdivision of the land would be ineffective? Or what's your position with regard to that?
I believe that it would be ineffective. If this court were to dismiss the case, it would have to unwind everything that the land court had done.
If I may ask, what's going on with that lot right now? Is there any activity, any type of...
Interesting that you should ask, Justice. Kahoma has made use of the property. They planted an orchard there. They also had a four-wheeling tourist adventure there. They have a zip line there.
It's on 3A.
Is on 3A, correct. They also have a house that they moved up there. And because they said they weren't going to claim the other percentage, one of my clients actually moved on to the property, which met with a lot of resistance from Kahoma, even though they said they didn't claim all of the interest in the property. And so, but that's the use, Justice.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can that's I ask one more question? I mean, are you also suggesting, I mean, the bottom line, if this were dismissed and something else was subsequently filed, that basically we would be having the adverse possession trial that was sort of short-circuited to a certain extent by the MSJ from Judge Chang?
I am not aware of the motion for summary judgment by Judge Chang being granted. I'm aware of the default judgment being granted by Judge Chang, and it would set that aside. There was one motion for summary judgment to disenfranchise the heirs of Kahonu, who I represented, brought by Kahoma. Judge Chang did find that there was a genuine issue of material fact for trial. So that never happened. But other than that, I'm not aware of any other motion for summary judgment.
If this court were to adopt your position, it would probably be necessary for us to order a remand to the land court to set aside some of the, like the subdivision, right?
Correct. And if I have just a second more, our alternative is if this court remands it, that this court order that the land court serve all of the parties that are known. And after they are served, then conduct the trial as was required by this Supreme Court.
Wouldn't it make more sense to make sure that everyone that is entitled to notice actually gets it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's the alternative relief.
That's the alternative.
Order service on everybody and then hold the trial that was supposed to happen back in the 1970-ish, early 70s.
Correct, because I think if all of the parties are noticed, you're not going to get a default judgment. People are Kamehameha Schools is going to show up for their one-third. Yeah. Thank you,
Justices. Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kau. Mr. Schultz.
afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. May it please the court. My name is W. Keone Schultz, and with me at counsel's table is Doreen Masuoka, and we represent respondent appellee substitute applicant Kahoma Land LLC. One of the interesting facts about this matter is that no matter what the court rules today, and there are a lot of interesting facts, I will concede, one interesting fact is that the appellant's potential 21.926% interest in Lot 3A is going to be unaffected for good or bad by what the court determines today. That was the entire point of the request of the land court that the appellant's consolidated 21.2% interest be carved out and left out of the decree. And that's sort of because one of the quirks of the land court is that only the applicant's title is determined when a property is registered. And even though a party might show up and object, the land court application cannot determine that party's interest. And so that was sort of the limited nature of the land court decree, that it only pertained to the 78.7% interest that Kahoma sought to register. And again, when you look at the property, the parties whose 78.7% interest was registered, I actually would like to dispute Mr. Kapu's statement, where I think back in 1920, the trustees of the land trust were actually given notice of the application. And I believe that's at ICA docket 119 at 113 and 116, where there appears to be a register of all the property, of all the parties that were given notice of Pioneer Mill's application. And
notice via what? Registered mail?
Via registered mail.
Right. So that is actually an interesting question. I think the ICA had said in Hustis, and it was a different type of case, but it did say that depreciation of property solely on the basis of substituted service in adverse possession actions is constitutionally deficient in situations where, with the use of due diligence, actual notice is possible. Now, I was a little bit unclear whether that meant personal service or whether service by mail.
Yeah, and I will concede that under modern standards, under Hustis, the service back then was does not comply with Hustis. But for the time, the registration, the notice of the application was sent, is my understanding, to these parties. And in 1920, these parties made a decision to not intervene in the application. And that default of these properties, of these parties, then continued for 100 years, while obviously appellants and many other parties came into the case and had their defaults set aside. That is the point about these 78.7% whose interest was registered in Kahoma, is that though obviously a lot of parties had chances to intervene and the land court allowed them to intervene, these 78.7 never did. And so after 100 years, after, a trial, and, it was before this court twice, the land court entered decree 2017 just as to that 78.7% interest, and not at all, it does not apply at all to the 21.2% collective owned by the appellants here. And I think that's one of the distinctions, and it's sort of a quirk of the land court. I don't believe that if the court affirms the 78.7% interest, they can then use, Kahoma could then use res judicata as to these properties, because they actually were specifically carved out of the decision by the land court. And so they have a right to come in and prove their individual interests. And that kind of goes to, the nature of a co-tenancy. And, I understand the appellant's argument is that there is a sort of a communal ownership, but that's not really what a co-tenancy is. A co-tenancy is just your individual interest in a property. You cannot choose your co-tenant. You cannot prevent your co-tenant from selling their interest. If your co-tenant wants to bring a partition action, you are subject to that partition action under Chapter 668. So, it is distinct property right that I think appellants try to sort of gloss over here. But, this court, I think, needs to be mindful of that. You know, these co-tenants back in 1920 made a decision not to object to the application, and then they continue.
How do we know that? How do we really know that?
Admittedly, we don't really know that, but we know they did not appear, whereas parties did consistently appear. And you know, I would say
two
that
princesses appear. How do we know that it was intentional?
Two large land trusts, which tend to be represented well by attorneys, and you know, so we don't know. But that is the fact: is that the trustees of both the Luna Leo Trust and the Bishop Estate were sent by registered mail of the application. And, you know, I mean, obviously, appellants wish that a different decision had been made by the large land trusts back in 1920. We kind of know the history of who was the trustees back then. And, you know, those are the facts. And what the facts are, again, that there was no decision to come in at that time or in the subsequent 100 years.
What about the argument that Cahoma and its predecessor, Pioneer Mills, hasn't shown adequate diligence in this action? There are long decades of inaction, and it's sort of couched in terms of the legal doctrine of latches. But what's your response to that? At some point, it's simply gone on too long.
I admit I had a visceral reaction when I was first given this case. I was like, wow, 1919, that's older than a long time. But again, the land court has the discretion to look at all the individual facts as to why this got here. And, you know, in 1972, after this case had been sitting for 50 years, this court chose not to invoke latches or dismiss the case and it sent it back down. So I don't have an explanation as to why it took so long. But again, what I would point out is that
So how do you defend against latches? Because you got 26 years after 72 and nothing's going on, nothing.
Sure.
Nothing is blank.
I'm sorry, Justice Devens.
I mean, you know, nothing's reflected at all.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't latches apply in that case?
Yeah. I view latches as being something about, as being related more to the instigation of the case.
No, there's case law saying that latches applies even after a case has been begun.
Yeah.
It's a lack of prosecution. It's just sitting there. 26 years, no explanation, nothing at all. Unreasonable delay, prejudice. I mean, don't those two elements?
And again, the parties, the appellants here have suffered no prejudice because by decree 2017, their interests remain completely unresolved.
The motion was based entirely on evidence that had been presented in the 1972 trial with no opportunity to cross-examine these dead witnesses. How is that not prejudice?
Well, again, the parties that are here today, the 21.2% owners, they have no prejudice suffered. As to the 78.7% owners whose interests were registered, you know, again, they were given notice in 1919, and then they have not come into this case during that entire time. So I believe that the land court, you know, looked at the record, maybe looked at the land court's own decision-making and not pushing the case forward, and factored that all into the decision. And I believe, you know, it's an abuse of discretion review as to the land court's decision-making as to whether it should apply latches or not. And I submit that the land court chose correctly.
You're not saying it was the land court's obligation to push the case forward, though, right? That's on the petitioner.
But it's also on the land court as well, I believe.
Well, you can ask the court to move it along, set the trial, and let's move. None of that happened.
I concede that I may have made some different choices in this matter, Justice, but, you know, the facts are what the facts are, and the land court, you know, looked at it and made its decision that it was not appropriate to dismiss for latches.
I understand your position. Thank you.
Please continue.
I think it kind of comes back to the land court statute. I guess I'll adjust the jurisdictional arguments raised. The land court, again, by its own statute, has the power to amend an application in the middle of the matter and does have the right and the ability to determine that a party only has a percentage of interest in a registered property. And so here.
Does that usually happen in adverse possession cases?
It has happened more than I would have thought after reading the case law. You know, nowadays, admittedly, because of the standard of you can't adverse possess a co-tenant, it becomes harder. And the interesting thing here, again, is that the land court actually found that under a default standard of proof of evidence that Kahoma had adverse possessed the entire property, but because it was only seeking to register 78.7 interest, that was all that the land court was going to register, and it again specifically sat aside the 21.2% interest. So you can register, and there's a number of cases where a percentage interest in a property was registered through adverse possession.
And adverse possession back in prior to 1919?
Correct.
And that's based on the trial record from the trial that Judge King presided over?
I believe that the evidence showed that prior to the application being filed, that Pioneer Mill had showed evidence of adverse possession of the full Lot 3A through its sugarcane operations on the lower, its flumes higher. And there is Hawaii case law that says, you know, if you can show sufficient adverse possession of parts of a property, that it will extend to the full.
But that was based on testimony from the trial.
That was based on testimony of the trial, which the court reviewed under a admittedly lower standard because it only applied on default of the 78.7% onus.
So is that appropriate going forward to allow that evidence, which, again, as Justice McKenna pointed out, is not subject to adversarial testing?
I believe so because, again, Kahoma has a right. The default of a party has to mean something. And in this case, there was a default in 1920, and it continued for 100 years until Decree 2017 was issued. And, you know, I understand the court's concerns, but if a party decides to continue to allow itself to be defaulted or takes no action, and again, we were talking about a full sugar plantation being run on at least the lower part of 3A with flumes and other things up above. And so, you know, at some point, there was all kinds of notice. I mean, with sugar, obviously they burn the thing to the ground at least once a year, which seems to be a pretty good sign of adverse
possession. What's on 1 and 2?
I am not familiar enough with it. I believe they're nearby, so I believe it was part of the sugar plantation at one point.
You're able to go through the record and confirm that all of the folks who you believe got notice back in 1919 or 1920, how can you confirm they actually received notice? And is there a universe of people beyond that, or is that actually a very precise set of the folks who have an interest in this property?
My understanding based on the record is that first the land court examiner made a recommendation of what party should be given notice. And then Pioneer Mill hired two other title experts to go out and attempt to figure out who these heirs of for the different parcels. And those were the two sets of parties that were then put into the publication notice and then sent notice of the land court's application, of the land court application. So
through publication?
Through publication, posting, and actually registered mail. And again, I believe that the record shows it's at ICA docket 119 at 113, pages 113 to 116, where there's a sort of this long list of parties. And I believe that back then...
It's a list of parties.
It's a list of parties. And I believe the document says that parties were sent registry of the application.
It's a representation.
I believe it's a representation by the court that
right,
those were the parties.
But not like signatures with return receipt requests.
That is correct. Right. So I won't make a representation that I guarantee that they were, you know, they received registered mail returns back then. My understanding is back then you literally could just put in guy's name and their address in Honolulu, and it was a small enough town back then that the postmaster could find them.
It does appear, though, that the parties who appeared, the five who did, at least from my reading of the ICA docket, only appeared subject to publication or pursuant to publication, which implies a lack of registered mail, or at least on their parts.
Yeah, I can't speculate as to what notice the trustees of the Kamehameha Schools, I believe that they actually got registered mail notice per the court's record. But for the other individual parties, the record is unclear to me.
Understood.
And again, I guess turning to what this court decided back in 1972, I don't believe that there was a new trial mandate in that the parties had to come up with and start with opening arguments. I believe that any time a matter is, remanded to a court, it does have some jurisdiction to use common sense and, see what's about to happen. And here, a number of things had changed between 1972 and 2008 when Kahoma sought to register its interest here. And, the state of Hawaii in 1993 did concede that it no longer was claiming an interest in Lot 3A, which had been one of the bigger points of contention for the previous 100 years. And so I thought it was appropriate at that point. And one of the interesting facts is one of the things the land court did in 2008 and then going forward is it did set aside the defaults of the appellants and all the other parties that came forward. In other words, technically under the land court, it had its ability to say, nope, you were defaulted in 1920 and again in 1965, and so your default stays. Instead, the land court did, using its powers under HRS 5152, allowed them to come in and to contest. And so that's again just one of the little quirks about the land court is that it can and it's only supposed to focus on the appellant, but it can allow other parties to come in and raise issues, which it did. But then ultimately decided that because 78.7 parties had defaulted and continued to default, that it ruled as it did.
Also, can I ask you if the IC is affirmed, where does the litigation go from there?
At this point, Kahoma would be a 78.7 owner of the property, and then there is still a definite issue as to what happens with the 21.2%.
So are they going to continue that battle against the 21%?
It was. I would hope to think that some type of solution could be reached out because it is 340 acres, but. There is no.
What did you say about the acreage?
I believe it's 340 acres total, and there is a chance that you could make some type of solution. It would involve everyone participating, but I don't have a direct answer right now. It was fortunate. This is one of the few properties that the fire actually burned below it. Versus on it, so that is one of the good things.
Mr. Schultz, this court's decision in 1972 said this case is remanded for a new trial. How is it that a trial could not be held under those circumstances?
Well, and again, it would. Our argument is, of course, that a new trial is not necessary as to this 78.7%, and indeed, because Kahoma is only seeking to register. 78.7% and leave out the 21.2, that 21.2 is again completely free for the appellants to make whatever claims, whether it be in the land court to seek registration of it or file a Chapter 669 quiet title partition and a partition action under 668, they would have the right. So I guess that's the point is that our position is that because the way that Kahoma decided to reform its application, that a new trial would not be necessary.
And what's your response to Mr. Matsukawa's argument that reformation of the petition went so far as to deprive the land court of jurisdiction?
I think if they had raised the issue at the time that the reformation occurred, the land court, under its powers, under HRS 501-26, amendments to the application, including joinder, substitution, or discontinuing as the parties, shall be allowed by the court at any time upon terms that are just and reasonable. So the application could have been easily amended at that point, and indeed, the land court, one of the powers of the court is that this is under HRS 501-52, the court may make and take all other steps necessary for the promotion of justice. So there was a bunch of tools in the toolkit that the land court could have used at that point if it had been raised at that point. And so I think the arguments are waived. And again, it's more a technical issue. It's not really jurisdictional because the land court has a right to also, as discussed, okay, well, you claimed 100, but you only have 78%, so we're only going to register that. So it's just sort of part of the powers that the land court has, and it could have been solved. I think it would also be sort of a waste if the court remanded just for that issue of, okay, start a new application and then, you know, issue the decree 2017 again.
Maybe not deprive of jurisdiction, you know, that's your argument, but it may render the application defective, and that would be on your client to fix that.
It would, Your Honor. But again, I think that it if all the remand were be, and I understand there's other options out there, but if it was only to fix this issue of what are you seeking to register, I think it would be judicially inefficient to do so.
Justice Devens asked you what would happen if we affirmed the ICA. What if we went the direction that Mr. Matsukawa and Mr. Ka'apu argue for and declare the petition void ab initio? What would happen then? What would the implications of such a ruling be?
Obviously, it would be somewhat severe for our clients because right now they have been declared an owner of a 78.7 undivided interest in the property, and so that property right would be essentially erased. And then it would sort of go back to what is the exact directions on remand. If it's completely unwound, then yeah, my client would have an opportunity of that or an option. Do we seek to register again under Chapter 501, or do we bring a quiet title case under Chapter 669 seeking quiet title to the full 240, by adverse possession prior to 1919? And so I know appellants don't really agree with this, but this is almost a better solution for them in that I think Cahoma is sort of, again, frozen from doing anything with their 21.2% interest that has been set aside.
But what about parcels 1 and 2?
Yeah, I think parcels 1 and 2, because they didn't really raise the issue on appeal, I think this court, I guess, could carve it out. And it doesn't seem to be any dispute that Cahoma was able to show paper title in parcels 1 and 2 as found by the land court. And my understanding of parcels 1 and 2 is not nearly as well just because the record as 3A was so voluminous and I tried to focus on that.
If the court went the other way, just off the top of your head, would res judicata come into play in any way if it went off on latches? So that adverse possession could not be reasserted?
Oh, I don't think that would be appropriate. I think that would be a takings of Cahoma's rights. You know, if that was you could not then assert adverse possession. I think the way that adverse possession works legally is that once the period of adverse possession runs, title technically transfers from the person who's adverse possessed to the owner. So, you know, the position would be that legally title passed to Pioneer Mill in and around 1915, 1919.
What if it was 100 years later?
Well, that's the one thing about adverse possession is that once you have adverse possession, there is no requirement that you then bring a claim for adverse possession.
What if it was 500 years later?
That's kind of the thing about adverse possession is that the longer is
how do you show the adverse possession? How do you show the facts of adverse possession?
You just show the evidence of open, obvious, notorious possession.
How do you show that when people died 500 years ago? I mean, how do you show that? That's my question.
Well, I understand. And, you know, there will be some evidentiary challenges, but there is ample records. As found by the land court, when the land court ruled in Decree 2017, it was all based on evidence that was put in prior to the application in 1919. So there it showed the crop records, the field records, locations of flumes, and any other evidence that Mr. Moore put in through the business records. And, the business records of Pioneer Mill are still available. I think some of them have been transferred to University of Hawaii sugar plantation things. So the evidence still exists, but it would be more challenging. I'm not going to you know, hide from that fact.
Mm-hmm.
What about the subdivision? What would happen if we were to hold that there was a lack of jurisdiction in the land court? What would happen to the subdivision?
I believe the subdivision would have to go away if that was the court's exact ruling. And, you know, again, that's you have a whole bunch of different titles here in this application. And, again, I don't believe there is much dispute as to lots one and two. And, again, appellants aren't claiming lots one and two, is my understanding. So focus should just be on lot 3A.
The state took a part of lot 3, right?
That is my understanding. And, you know, the state challenged the ownership of the property all the way until the settlement in 1993, is my understanding.
And it was actually the state that pushed for the trial after the 1972 remand.
It was the state that pushed for the trial, and it was the state that then appealed Judge King's order and sought to toss it out because he had applied for the governorship a month or two before the final.
But if this court did rule in 1972 that the March 13th trial decision was, he was without jurisdiction. So that would also pertain to the subdivision order, which is the same date.
I agree that would be an issue if this court were to decide that latches should result in the incomplete unwinding of the matter. And so that's why I encourage
this is not a latches issue. Okay. This court ruled in 1972 that he was without jurisdiction on March 13th, 1970. And the subdivision order was dated March 13th, 1970, the same date as his trial findings. So he was without jurisdiction. The entire subdivision order was without jurisdiction. I'm wondering why people decided to proceed with it.
Well, I don't have a good answer for that. My best response would be that when the land court then at this point, which then again had jurisdiction, could go ahead and declare, as part of the remand, could declare the subdivision valid and recognize the lots. And indeed, that's what the land court here did. So I would say that that's sort of affirming or replacing any improper order.
What would the basis have been for that subdivision?
Again, the record before the parties and the further stipulation by the state of Hawaii and the Pioneer Mill in 1993.
Thank you.
Very well. Anything further for the court at this time, Mr. Schultz?
No, nothing further, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Matsukawa, your rebuttal.
Thank you. One thing I'd like the court to focus upon is the 78%, 21% adverse possession, these what I call sub-issues that are lurking behind the land court's decree. If the court focuses on its new trial mandate of 1972, and this court's ruling in State versus Lincoln, which explains the scope of a new trial on a new trial order mandate. In State versus Lincoln, the court took the time to say, when we give you the case back, you do what you're told. Don't intermeddle with it. Don't question our reasoning. And in that State versus Lincoln case, this court cites to Beverly Hills Bancorp. It's in the published decision. And in that case, what had happened was, same thing, appellate court remanded. On remand, rather than do the new trial as mandated, the trial court allowed the plaintiff to amend his pleading and create a new theory for relief. Case went on to another trial, appeal went back. The court said, we did not tell you to play around and amend the pleadings, change the theory of the case. We told you, hold the new trial as it was laid out in the pleadings. So this 74%, 21%, what I call device or ruse, was conducted or made up to avoid holding a new trial.
And that's why we're here today. And as to Justice Devin's comments as to how do you explain some of this long periods of delay, my observation has been when you read the land court published decisions and some of the literature about the land court, you could see that during the territorial period when the land court statute was enacted, 1903, it was like a special statutory court. Who were the parties? Large landowners, plantations, large ranchers. These are all the people who went to the land court, Kohala Sugar Company, Shipman, Kanehohe Ranch. So I like to call it a sort of a special club that had its own process and ways of doing things. Some may be informal, unpublished, but nevertheless a culture that carried over into statehood. And as you can see, it has some strong roots and influence on the land court, because as recently as 2009, the land court seemed to be functioning in that same manner.
Land court was here.
Yes.
And so if a pro se person, a self-represented person, had received a registered mail back in 1919, and they wanted to contest it, how do they do that?
They had to file an answer and wait for a trial setting. That's what the statute says. When you read the statute as to what happens after service is made, they file an answer and then they await a hearing. And the hearing would usually follow by the statute.
The hearing would be here?
In Oahu, yes.
In Oahu?
Yes.
How did people come back and forth back then?
The statute did allow the land court to refer the case to a circuit court judge on the neighbor islands as a special master who would do the work of a master and submit recommendations to the land court judge in Oahu, who could either accept it, modify it, or reject it. But yes, access would have been rather difficult in the early 1900s.
Mr. Mutzko, anything further for the court at this
time?
All right. Very well. Thank you to our attorneys today for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Hey, Ku Iluna, please rise.
Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki eke hanahana o kamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.